for contemporary Africa and for diaspora African photography has been the medium that has really brought the most light, the most opportunities to black thinking and black consciousness all over the world. It's made our stories easier to be seen. It's made it harder to ignore.
Says Azu Nwagbogu, curator and founding director of the African Artists Foundation, whose Instagram profile says he's preparing a larger table. Welcome to our podcast, Was macht die Kunst? Azu, tell me more about the larger table you're preparing. Who shall be seated at this table?
Thank you, Lisa. It's really good to be here. And thank you for inviting me on your platform. The idea of a larger table really is to shift the emphasis from the hero curator or the hero personality to invite broader conversation. And that's what I believe in making space and room for more voices, basically, that are really, really relevant today. I think that fundamental to the work that we all do in the 21st century is that we realize that the individual is such a powerful entity. And I think that's the one significant change from, say, the 20th century. And with that consciousness, it means that we really need to support each other and build up, you know, the next generation.
In 2007, you founded the African Artists Foundation. So what you just explained, is this at the core of the foundation? Maybe you can explain a little bit what all the initiatives are that have started from this foundation.
You know how it is. When you start a thing like the African Artists Foundation, an idea like that, you don't really know where you're going. You have an idea, a vision. You think you know what you're doing, but you really don't, because as you begin to do it, you really learn a lot. The one instinct that was fundamental to starting the foundation was we felt the need. We felt the hunger. We felt that there was a real urgency for contemporary artists to play a role in society, a wider role in society, and that's really important. So basically, I just created a platform, and we launched with the very important art prize, where annually we gave quite a large cash prize to the best contemporary artist, or the guys who won the prize, rather than the best. You know, it's always hard to say who's the best are, but we had a theme that was driven, that was ideated by the curatorial committee, and we had Ellen Atsui, who's a really important artist and a dear friend, head the committee and select the winners. So we did that for 10 years, and I think it played a really significant role in, in identifying and supporting the best contemporary artists on the continent.
Wow. Well, El Anatsui is beloved everywhere. I saw the fantastic installation at the Tate.
The Tate, amazing show.
It's amazing. And then I went to Kunstpalast Düsseldorf lately.
Oh, yes.
And there's, one of the most exciting rooms, and there are many exciting rooms, is El Anatsui on one side, and then directly in dialogue, a Rubens altarpiece. So that's really fantastic.
Absolutely. I mean, I think El Anatsui is the example of what I mean by you can be a pivot, important. You can be a genius like Elle, but you can still play a role in enabling other people to come up. And Elle is a perfect example of that. He's been super generous with his time, with his resources, with his knowledge, and he supported a lot of artists, even post his university days. So it's really quite great. He's an inspiration.
He's from Ghana, right?
Well, we like to claim him in Nigeria.
Oh.
But he's a Ghanaian, but he's lived in Nigeria, in Nsukka, in the eastern part of the country, where he's been teaching for over 40 years. So he's lived in Nigeria for over 50 years.
Okay. And you are a Nigerian patriot.
Now,
where did you grow up? In Lagos?
I did. I grew up in Lagos mostly, but my family is sort of huge. I come from a very large family, so we travel a lot. We move around a lot, so yeah. But I did grow up in Lagos mostly.
And when you were a kid, did the arts play a role in your family?
Massive, massive role. You know, we have, as I say, I have five brothers and three sisters in a very, sort of nuclear family. And we had people writing poems, painting, drawing, and reading, writing. And we had a very diverse talent in our family, so it really did play a massive role. My parents as well.
How did you become a curator? Did you also toy with the idea of becoming an artist yourself?
No, there was never a chance of me becoming an artist. I never had any sort of, maybe the talent was never there, or really the interest was never there. It was, for me, it was always about creating scenarios. And I think I always had that impulse to be a curator from the earliest impulse that I had as a young thinker. Yeah. So it sort of fell on my lap, really. I gravitated towards artists. I was always conscious about what was going on in society, locally and internationally. And I always wanted artists. I wanted to work and think and be in the room with artists who had this sort of consciousness around the possibilities of what art could do in the 21st century or, you know, in the present time.
And do you have a special love for photography?
Sometimes I say to people, oh, I don't have a special love for photography, but that's not really true. The truth is, I think that I'm biased, very biased towards photography, because I think for contemporary Africa and for diaspora Africans, I'm talking about African Americans and Africans in diaspora everywhere, photography has been the medium that has really brought the most light, the most opportunities to Black thinking and Black consciousness all over the world. It's made our stories easier to be seen. It's made it harder to ignore. So I think photography has that power and that immediacy, that urgency. And also because I'm really interested in this idea of, you know, how in the past you had religion played a very big role, schools, family had a bigger role to play in sort of creating structures in society. I think that we sort of have lost that now. We've lost those sort of formal outside nuclear home structures that enable us to build society, you know, the crutches that we stand on. I think that we become more individualistic as a people. And it means that photography allows you to tell your own story, that you can see the way Instagram and social media is a double-edged sword. It allows you to really publish your own ideas, but also it exacerbates the problems that we have in society, misinformation, fake news, lies, you know, ego, and all of those other things become a problem.
Yeah, I've never thought about it in that way, but that photography and identity has so much to do with each other. Even when you look at teenagers, how they use their iPhone cameras, yeah. That really you present yourself in a way. Everyone uses photography today. It's
Absolutely.
Really, it's a medium that it's no hurdle to,
no
to get
hurdle,
to photography.
No boundaries, no. But I still think that if you're going to be a professional artist, photographer, and you're going to do it, you have to really learn how to use your tools. You know, I work with a lot of artists who love photography, who believe in photography as a medium and as a tool, but they don't do enough work to understand that you have to really master that tool. Just the same way painter, you know, you have to know how to paint. You have to learn how to use the medium, master the material. And, you know, if you want to do it right, that's the difference, I suppose, between the artist and, say, the average citizen on the street.
So what are some experiences that you found memorable about the Lagos Photo Festival that you founded? It's also part of the African Artists
yes,
Foundation,
it is.
Right?
Yeah, we founded the Lagos Photo Festival in 2010.
Yeah.
And I think one of the most memorable incidents that we had was when we started, we had an idea to bring in photojournalists with in the same exhibition with the art photographers. We had people like Jerome Delay, who's a head of AP in South Africa, was it Reuters, one of those, in the same exhibition with Samuel Fosso. And at the time, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, so whatever it was highly unusual. You know, you had your photojournalist exhibitions and you had your artist exhibitions, super separate. Nobody really mixed these two. But for me, it was about the sensibility of the work and the stories they were telling. And I remember we had a project about Samuel Fosso, who's a really important, you know, Nigerian photographer. And the Cameroonians like to claim him, but he was born in Nigeria. But he had this project called African Spirits and also the Black Pope. And we exhibited that in Lagos Photo. And in the same year, we had Jerome Delay show his work from the war in Sudan, I think it was. And I remember Jerome coming up to me and going, oh, wow, this guy's a genius. Wow, never seen anything like this. He was going on and on about how much he loves some of us' work. And then 3 months later, I think it was, there was a war in Central African Republic where some of us has a studio. And they had ransacked his studio and all of his archives and negatives were on the street. And Jerome Delay recognized the work just by being, because it was embedded with the French army soldiers that were sort of trying to bring peace and stabilize the region. And so Jerome literally rescued the entire Samofoso archive. And he called me immediately to say, wow, you know, if I wasn't in Lagos, this would be gone, because he didn't know it was important until he met Samofoso. So that's one of my favorite stories to tell about Lagos Photo and the gathering, the rencontre, the meeting of artists from all over the world, the French artists meeting the Cameroonian, Nigerian artists in Lagos. And it's a really powerful thing to be able to host, you know, host ideas, host people and bring them together.
Wow, that's beautiful. And where does it, it also has an online presence, but it's also taking place physically in Lagos. And is it in one venue? Or?
No, we have the exhibition in minimum of 6 indoor venues, and then all over the streets, all over the public spaces and major roundabouts and the universities, the high schools, on the street. We really try to make it a huge a celebration of photography.
Wow, that's amazing. When's the next edition taking place?
The next edition, the last weekend in October every year. It's always the last weekend in October. So yeah, 2024.
Wow.
We'll have the 15th edition of the Lagos Photo Festival.
Wow. How can art contribute to making underrepresented groups more visible in society and telling their stories?
That's a great question. I think that art already does that, even though it doesn't have to have the burden of having that label on it and shoulders. I think that artists are constantly trying to be seen, making work, trying to be heard. I'm very fortunate to have been invited by National Geographic to be an ambassador, to be an explorer at large. And so in that role, I really am able to support the work that National Geographic does in bringing diverse voices from all over the world to become explorers, to be able to give us the fuller, richer picture of the world. I think that's really something that is relevant today more than ever before, you know, to see the world as one piece, one whole. The idea is not to make everything the same. We're not trying to dilute cultures. It's not about that, but it's about respecting other and seeing the humanity in other cultures. And I think that's what art can do, and giving a platform for artists from all over the world to be able to really present their ideas and share their stories. I think that's powerful.
And I like the idea of African explorers going to places instead of only people going to Africa to explore Africa, but
absolutely,
the other way around.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think I was actually in Brazil. There's a one of those names that I seem to always forget, Julio. There was a great story with Gordon Parks in 67, I think it was. He was asked to tell a story about poverty in Brazil. And Gordon Parks went out to Brazil and did a beautiful photo essay, and he photographed a young Brazilian who was 6 or 9 at the time. And the story was, went viral, but there was no such thing as going viral back in the day, but it was such a huge sensation in the press at the time. And Americans, you know, came together and they raised money for the Brazilian, young Brazilian who was living in favela but didn't have access to health care because, you know, of poverty and the rest of it. And this story was about poverty. And they raised money and they got him out of Brazil, and they brought him to America, and they looked after him. So he had severe asthma. But the Brazilians were very upset with that, so they sent their own journalists to do a story about poverty in New York. So actually, I was in Brazil a few months ago, and I met with a young kid who's now an old man.
Oh.
And they're doing a Netflix series about it. I think it's really important in terms of exploration, or being an explorer, or trying to tell stories about the world, to show the idea of a common humanity. We all go through the same struggles regardless of where you live in the world. You know, emotionally, we're all the same.
I find it so important, this idea that it's always a two-sided thing. It's never, you know, one receiver and one giving, but it's really giving and
dialogue,
and,
exchange.
Exchange, right?
I think, you know, if you think about all the problems we have in this world, the foundation, the biggest sin, the biggest fundamental problem of humanity, colonialism, false hierarchy, you know, racism, all of these problems start from the idea that there's a sort of, you know, one-way exchange.
Yeah.
If we come to a situation with humility to think we can learn, we can exchange, we can dialogue, I see the humanity in you, I hope you can see it in me, the world would be so much kinder, so much better, so much fairer.
There's a word I read, I think it was an article in The Guardian about you. I thought that was a word you coined, Afro-pessimism.
People think I coined the word. I didn't actually.
No?
I didn't actually. I don't know why everyone thinks like
maybe it was The Guardian.
It's the idea, and I think maybe I championed the conversation as much as many curators, like Okwuenweso and a lot of other curators, really. The idea to the conception that, you know, it's a hopeless situation in Africa. We've been, you know, so it's almost like the idea that you cannot do anything about the situation on the continent. If you speak to 10 people on the street and you say, what do you think of Africa? They'll tell you the usual debt, disease, deprivation, poverty, whatever. But, you know, I travel all over the continent and, you know, that is not the story of the continent. So it's important that to create this consciousness that we all believe in and to represent the very real notion that we can deal with the problems of any situation, to present a broader story about Africa rather than the usual one-sided story. And Afro-pessimism is a pushback against the conception that you cannot do anything about the continent. It's just a hopeless situation with people with no agency and cannot help themselves. So that's really a lot of the work that we had done in Lagos Photo with photography is to push back against, was to push back against this conception and this idea. I think it's less a problem today because people, as I say, can publish their own stories and present individual stories about their lives in Africa. But at the time, you know, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, 20 years ago, Africa was always represented in through one particular lens, told by others. And it really problematized, did not complicate the situation. It really made it very easy to dismiss opportunity to fix things on the continent.
Yeah. What kind of city is Lagos in terms of the arts? I know that Nigeria is growing enormously. Now, how many? 230 million people.
That's
crazy. So Lagos, I don't know how many people live in Lagos, but it must be enormous.
20 million. That's crazy.
Wow.
But, you know, Lagos is one of those cities that I just got back from Lagos a few days ago. And every time I'm there, I'm actually surprised because, you know, I spend a lot of time traveling, but I go back and I think, oh, wow, that's actually cool. I don't actually want to leave. But it's really hard, you know, because you don't have a lot of support from the government, from institutions. So you have to really invent everything by yourself. But people are determined. People are creative and energetic and want to get things done. So it's, Nigerian music has, you know, culturally colonized the rest of the world, especially Africa. Everywhere you go, it's, you know, artists from the continent, visual artists, writers, Chimamanda. There's so many heroes now. And it comes from the complex conditions on the continent, right? And I think that it's also important that the conditions that produce these narratives, these stories, this creativity, we need to bring it back to nurture and develop the same context where it's come from. Because, you know, what you find is like, I make the analogy with the oil industry. You know, you have fossil fuels. And what are fossils? These are, you know, human animal remains that have been fossilized in the soil for millennia, right? And so a lot of the extraction economy where the crude oil is, you know, extracted from Africa and purified and processed and refined in other parts of the world and sold back to Nigerians as petrol and diesel and the rest of it. It's absurd. And I think that happens a lot in the art world where a lot of our artists, a lot of the talent comes from the conditions on the ground, but it's extracted and the best of it is seen outside of the continent. And then, you know, we receive piecemeal back home. So a lot of our top artists, even the musicians now, don't perform anymore in Nigeria. They barely perform. You know, you see them in the O2 Arena or in New York or in Amsterdam because the conditions aren't right to allow them perform back home. A lot of the visual artists, painters, artists, we don't have the space, the museums, to showcase the work that we do anymore. We outgrow the scene very quickly. And become the same old story where it's about extracting the talent, taking it outside, and then it's almost lost. So it's a real problem. And I think fundamental to fixing that problem is developing the infrastructure in the continent, because we have the intellectual architecture, but we need the physical architecture to allow us to be able to showcase the work of our creative people in Nigeria and in Africa.
So, for example, if I wanted to see a work by El Anatsui in Lagos?
Almost impossible. I mean, it would be in a private home.
Oh my God. Okay.
That's the sad thing. That's the reality.
Yeah.
So it's easier for you to see El Anatsui at the Tate or in
Düsseldorf.
or in 50 other museums in the world than to see it in any single space in Nigeria. It's really crazy. And that's the reality.
And that's also the lack of physical museums?
A lack of physical museum, lack of institutions that adequately, even in all over Africa, not just in Nigeria, all over Africa, it's a real problem.
But there is energy and there is dynamic of opening museums, including, you know, for the Benin bronzes, etc. So yes. Some museums are in the works, right?
I think there are, but you know, I have been involved and I've been championing this particular cause for a while now. I've been involved in, you know, I've worked as a director of a museum in Southern Africa, and I think it's the core problem. I think fundamentally, that is where we should be channeling a lot of our energy, building the support and the real ideas to allow the real, genuine talent to have a space to showcase their work and not make it this thing that is a replication of the Western idea of a museum. I think if you were to speak to people like at MoMA or the Met or whatever, or any of the top museums today, if they were trying to recreate a model for a museum today, I don't think they'll be using the model of the 20th century, because that served us for the last 100 years. But I think we need a new model that is more inclusive, that is easier to shift and shape than what we have now. A lot of the museums, a lot of the iconic museums are unwieldy. They're too big. They're hard to manipulate and to move. They're stuck in their old ways. So I think for an African museum, we need to be thinking about the museum of the future. How can a museum be more responsive to the shift in demographics, the shift in consciousness about knowledge system, pedagogy, and all of that stuff is really fundamental to how we create a new museum. I think a lot of institutions, a lot of museums, a lot of ideas that I hear about on the continent trying to replicate systems in the West that are not really fit for purpose.
Well, I think there are lots of museums in the West that also have to be thinking about how they are going to move into the future, because there are wonderful buildings with amazing collections and you go inside and there's no visitors. So there is really, it's a challenge for everyone to think.
It's a challenge. I think you say it right there, the Western museums are also dealing with the same problem. Then you can imagine a museum on the continent trying to copy a system that is trying to evolve.
Yeah.
You know, it's like you need to be thinking ahead of that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I believe that it's very important to find a way to get children early on into museums and into these institutions to know. For me, when I go into the city, anywhere I go, I look for a museum. And I would look at the whatever Brooklyn Subway Museum or something. I just like to see museums. What is it people pick? What is worthy to be shown? What is part of the identity that they want to represent? So I love to go to museums just to find out about weird collections or beautiful art. But I find it so important that people realize it could be their living room. Museums have to be inviting. They have to show, look, this is all of us. This is for you to look at. This is for you to feel welcome. So I feel that's something children have to learn early on.
Yeah, you're completely correct. It's the DNA of any city. If you go into a city and you go to the museums, it gives you a sense of the authenticity of the way people live and the way people are thinking and generating knowledge for the future and for the present. So I think you're right. It's really about targeting the younger generation, because they build, they're the ones that we're investing in for the future. So I think that's really core of what we need to be thinking of with museums.
Well, thinking ahead of the next year, 2024, there's exciting projects on the horizon for you in terms of the Venice Biennial. Can you say what you're doing there?
You know, it's really exciting. The Republic of Benin, one of the exemplar countries on the continent that have really adopted art and culture as a means to really transform society. The president of Benin, Patrick Talon, has taken and adopted art as a real core for the country. They believe that in sparking the and supporting the ingenuity of the people, the Benin people, the citizens can get a sense of self, a sense of confidence, a sense of trust in the systems that will allow them to find solutions for the problems of the country by themselves and develop the nation for themselves. So I was invited by the president and the team to head their inaugural participation at Venice Biennale in 2024. I've been working with the team over there, and we've done a lot of research, had several meetings for several months with all the custodians of culture in Benin, the high priest of voodoo. I met with them. I had a nice session with them. I've traveled across the continent, and we have a theme, and the theme for Venice Biennale 2024 would be Everything Precious is Fragile. And that's what we're working with, an idea of it allows us to deal with the ecological conditions, to deal with the past of Benin, the colonial past, the slave trade, the spirituality, and the way that the women were very fundamental in pushing back against slave trade, the Egoji warriors, the Amazons. So it's a really interesting theme, a really interesting topic, and I'm very excited to showcase the work of four exciting artists: Romuald Hazime, Mofuli Bello, Ishola Akpo, and Chloe Quinnam.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
And this will be the Pavilion of Benin?
In the Arsenale.
In the Arsenale. Wonderful.
Yeah.
And first time Benin has a...
First time. So it's really quite exciting. And we are very grateful that we are going to be in the Arsenale because, a lot of these new pavilions, when they come out to Venice, usually they get a palazzo outside and it's quite far.
Yeah.
And it's hard to know where it is and you lose a lot of time trying to get to it. But we're grateful that we're going to be in the Arsenale, and it's really quite an exciting time.
I have been very impressed with African arts at the Venice Biennial over the last couple of editions there. Often the most outstanding works were actually by African artists. So do you think this is a do you see this development, or is it just...
I think it's a real development. Yeah. I found out recently that Portugal have selected three artists, all with roots in Africa. So Monica de Miranda is one of the artists. I've worked with her a lot. So she's in Luanda, in Angola, and also lives in Lisbon. But it's going to be really exciting to see her work with a collective in Venice. The Netherlands, they've selected a Congolese collective that I'm also involved with to represent the Netherlands in Venice in 2024. South Africa, the French Pavilion, John Comfrey is going to be representing the British Pavilion in 24. So it's really going to be a lot of African artists, even representing Western nations in Venice in 2024, as well as, obviously, I'm sure there'll be a strong representation in the main exhibition that Adriana Pedrosa is curating. So yeah, I think it's going to be exciting to see a very rich, diverse festival of art at Venice in 24.
It's so great to have, with new perspectives and a new openness or a new surge of energy, just how exciting art is and how, there's always something new. And when you broaden your horizon, of course, you see more, and it's just very enriching.
It is. I think, that's credit to maybe COVID. I think COVID forced all of us to really slow down and think about how to deal with the problem of inclusion. What does it mean to have more women? What does it mean to present, to show a fuller, richer, more diverse world? I mean, as I say, the US is going to be showcasing the work of a Native American artist for Venice Biennale in 24. So I think, it's not hard. People will say, we need more talent. There is a talent. You just have to take the time to go look for it. Yeah. It's really exciting. I think if there's one thing that we can look forward to in the current chaos of the world with all the terrible things going on, is that art allows us to have a bit of hope. And with that hope, we can you know, sort of guide everyone towards our light. The hope it becomes a bit of a light that we can move towards, so we can sort of, you know, come out of this, you know, the sort of complex political, moral situation that we find ourselves in.
That's beautifully put. What you say about COVID forced us to take a step back. Do you think that COVID was also a time for technology to influence the creative process of artists?
I think so. I think that COVID created this liminal space where a lot of artists, curators, museums. I was in Brazil a few months ago, and I visited a really incredible space in Rio de Janeiro. And the director of the museum was explaining to me that, you know, they had a huge collection and they never had the time to really think about their collection and to think about how they could include more women, minority voices. But they had a lot of the works in the collection already, but through the pandemic, they were able to decelerate and really take the time to really reflect on what they had. And just to shut down the noise, you know, the urgency of what we need to show in 3 months or whatever, all the usual things that we get caught up in as cultural workers, and really do a bit of an audit about what they had and what they need. And they had such an incredible exhibition that was historical but also very contemporary. And I thought it was, you know, very special. And I asked, and, you know, he said it was down to COVID, and they were able to use a lot of technology to assess the collection and to reflect on, you know, when they got these old works, what they need to make it a bit more balanced, and what they need to fill the stories and the gaps in the collection and the history and that were sort of missing in the way they've been collecting, and also the way we connect with the world, you know, through tech, through Zoom, through. I think we were able to trust a little bit more in technology to allow us to create these meetings, to find those other networks that were sort of, you know, people would always say to you, oh, it's so hard to find women artists, or it's so hard to find black artists. But with COVID, I think, you know, we were able to have those meetings without actually traveling to Africa or to Latin America or to wherever. You can have a meeting and, you know, the artist can show you the work in the studio even remotely. I get a sense of it. Obviously, nothing beats a face-to-face. But I think, you know, we've begun to trust a little bit more in the possibilities of having these encounters and meetings through video tech.
Azu, you live in Berlin right now.
Yes, I do.
You travel a lot. Sounds like you go to all the continents all the time. Is Berlin a good hub for you, or what brings you to Berlin?
You know, it's a question that I answer, I think, every day. People ask me all the time, where do I live and why do I live in Berlin? I find that Berlin is the most intellectually stimulating for the work that I do. So it allows me to just find my balance, if you like. You know, I was just in Bali recently. I was in Brazil a few months ago. I was in Lagos. I mean, all of these places are great. But I think in Berlin, I can be not just anonymous, but I can also be my most quiet and my most at peace. And, you know, when I want to connect with friends, it's super easy and, you know, everything's around me. So Berlin is really an inspiring place for me to work from. I love it here.
What advice would you give to aspiring artists, especially those from emerging art scenes in Africa who aim to establish their voice in the global art community?
The one thing I'd say would be to not wait, just move, just start. And then when you do start, when you do move on with your exploration, your journey, you should really trust yourself. You should trust that you should stay with it, because a lot of artists, a lot of thinkers, a lot of curators, a lot of young people today, I get the sense that they think it's going to be easy. They think that things come easy. Good things do not come easy. So you have to really stay with it. You have to be willing to suffer in the Latin sense of the word. That is to, you know, to stay with the problem, to tarry, to, you know, to be dedicated and conscientious with your journey. You know, I think that's one thing that I'll share with young people, to be able to learn to enjoy the suffering, the dedication And then when you do it, the loneliness of creating, then when you do it, you will get the reward.
That's very nice. Well, one thing we haven't talked about yet, you have just come back from curating a show in Leiden. What kind of show is that?
Oh, it's one of the most fun of my fun exhibitions this year, actually. I've really enjoyed working with the team at the World Culturen Museum, the Museum of World Cultures at the College in the Netherlands. It's really an exhibition that is based on the sort of ethnographic collection from over 100 years. But they've asked me to select objects from the collection, but also to animate those objects with external impulses of the work by introducing the work of contemporary artists. So I'm really grateful to be able to have the work of artists like Yao Owusu from Ghana, Ibrahim Mahama, Renzo Martins from the Netherlands, the CATPC, African-American artists like John Henry as well. So it's a really exciting show that I think really shows that you can remediate, you can give even complex ethnographic collections that might have been collected through maybe not so knowledgeable means, or maybe through complex or biased or tendentious eyes, whatever it is, you can actually find a way to make those collections really relevant. And I think that the World Culture Museum in the Netherlands and Amsterdam, and in the Netherlands rather, the collection is incredible. They actually collected a Benin Nwangwu, one of the pioneers of modern art in Africa in the 60s, a very important piece that we didn't know that, you know, was in their collection. So it's really exciting to like go through like an old cupboard or an old, that's what it felt like for me, you know, like trawling through personal archives of the museum and finding the artist that I felt would be able to create a new relational aesthetics to the work by putting the work side by side with these artists. So it's an exciting show, and it opens on the 20th of next week. I don't know what the 20th is, whatever that is.
That's Wednesday.
It's a Wednesday, yeah. In Leiden, in the Museum of World Cultures in Leiden.
Wonderful. Yeah. So the artists that you named, like Ibrahim Mahama, they would react to a certain piece that you selected from the Leiden collection?
No, I rather would... well, we've had that situation. We had another artist, a young painter, who we invited to take a look at certain objects in the collection, and we asked him to make a piece. But with people like Mahama, it was more like I know his work and I know his practice and I know how his work deals with, you know, consumption, consumerism, trade, exchange, labor. So I wanted to bring work in conversation with certain objects in the collection that already had those narratives. Or like the work of Malik Wali, who's a photographer, and he made these portraits of young Senegalese boys and girls who are trying to find a new way of identifying themselves in society. But they're dressed in the same way as their forebears, but they have a totally different way of thinking about their identity and their youthfulness in society. So I thought it would be cool to bring his work, juxtapose it with all of these objects that were in the collection, but have a sort of different purpose, a different meaning. You know, it's like a critical design perspective in real time. So you imagine like these incredibly beautifully woven hats that were made 150 years ago, but passed down knowledge and been passed down through the generations to today. The young Senegalese people are still wearing those sort of hats and those objects, but it means a totally different thing from 100 years ago till today. They've been able to make it more hip and more contemporary and more, I don't know. It's really quite fun to have a way of looking at the past in a very contemporary way and through fresh eyes. So yeah, it's one of those fun exhibitions that I've enjoyed thoroughly.
If time travel was real, where would you go and what period would you visit?
Several. That's a great one. I'd love to see what it was like to hang around with people like Socrates, the foundation of Western philosophy. I really want to know if he wrote all of those books. So I'll be thinking about, 300 years BC or 400 years BC, something like that. Then obviously I want to be like, you know, hang around with the Middle East, find out what
In the Middle East?
Yes, I think so.
At what time?
The Middle East 2,000 years ago, walking around with Jesus, he was really making all the miracles and finding out what was going on there.
What is your most important tool?
My most important personal tool would be my memory. I think I'm able to create all my work in my head, but other than that, I'd say my phone. My phone has to be the next one, but my memory is really my most important personal tool. I'd hate to lose it.
If you were an animal, what would it be?
Ah, easy. A jaguar.
Which game do you like to play?
I used to play chess. I was actually quite good at it back in the day. But basketball, physical. I'm not really into physical activity. I don't do a lot of, but if I did, it would be basketball. But other than that, chess would be my
second favorite game.
Yeah.
What's your favorite color?
It used to be blue, but I think now it's black. Now I wear black a lot.
Yeah, you are wearing all black, except for your socks. I saw your socks are very bright. Do you have a recurring dream?
Yes, I do have a recurring dream. I have a dream where I'm flying. I always have that dream every maybe 3-4 times a year.
Do you listen to music while you work?
I do. Bach, Fela Kuti, Biggie Smalls, Notorious B.I.G. Yeah. I listen to music that is super familiar, music that I have all the words and all the lyrics in my head already. So I listen to a podcast as well. Yeah. Oh. One that is super familiar, nothing new.
Which topic would you like to see an entire issue of Weltkunst of?
I'm a big fan of Weltkunst, and I think it would be wonderful to see an entire issue dedicated to something as ridiculous and abstract as love. Like, what does that mean? And how do you think about love as a great topic?
Can you share a wisdom?
Wisdom? Anytime you're sort of trying to learn about any situation, you should completely separate the emotion from and focus on the facts. And when you have learned the facts, then you may be able to introduce the emotion. But if you mix the two, it's very hard for you to understand the truth. So I think it's important that we, when you try to undergo any sort of research, start with the raw facts. And then you have the facts that you can decide what you do with the rest of your feelings. Because I think we all get the two intertwined in things that we're involved in.
Thank you very much. I'm so happy that you agreed to be on the podcast. Thank you so much.
Pleasure, really. Thank you.
Thank you, our faithful audience, for listening. We'll be back in January, thanks to our partner Volkswagen Group, who is also supporting Volkswagen Group Art for All Family Sundays, which will be back on January 7th at Hamburger Bahnhof, Nationalgalerie der Gegenwart, Berlin, offering a great variety of workshops and activities and a reduced ticket price for families. Come in and join!